guys, and welcome back to the second episode of Oracles of the Cult, Virgil. So, we're going to be talking about patrons, patronesses, deity collectors, priesthood, and god spouses. And let's have it known that most of these, we're going to be talking in it from kind of like demonolatry light. But we're very excited to talk about the subject because we do experience, at its core, they're truly beautiful things. Like priesthood and god spousing and patrons and patronesses, those are absolutely gorgeous things and gorgeous connections to have until it becomes unhealthy or until it becomes toxic, not just towards you, but towards the people around you. Because, you know, people are really influenced by those who claim to be, like, elder witches. Especially, like, the idea of just patrons, priesthood, god spouses, they're all labels, and they all, even if they don't attend to, give a sense of superiority and authority. And so people will automatically look up to you when you have those titles and when you use those titles. And so we're gonna start with patrons and patronesses, and I'm gonna throw it to Valkyrie to kind of introduce the couple definitions of that.
We're going to talk about the origin of the word patron, which comes from patronage. So, first of all, when it comes to that relating to humans, if someone is your patron, that would mean that they sponsor you. They're a benefactor. So let's say that someone is a very talented upcoming artist. Someone with a lot of money recognizes them and sponsors them to go to art school. That person would be their patron. And in a more traditional sense, when that comes to deities, a deity can be a patron of a thing, place, or idea. So it's not necessarily that they sponsor it, but they do rule over it and are seen as responsible for its well-being or its care. So for example, Athena is a patron of Athens. Archangel Michael is a patron of, pretty sure, defense in some areas. So it could also be seen as something that they rule over. And the way that this has translated into witchcraft and our practice is patronage is the entity that you could say that they sponsor you, like they magically back you up, they're there for you, they're by your side. And they're seen as the entity that you work closest with. And you usually have an extremely deep, and as Corellia said before, an extremely beautiful connection that is most of the time described as very, very parental.
Yeah, you can also be seen with who you were closest with at the time. So for some people, it does change by your definition. So when people talk about patrons, I always like to ask what their definition of patron is. Although for the most part, I think a majority of like the practitioners that I talk to kind of see patron as this lifelong commitment or these entities that are going to be with you your entire life. Some people have like one patron, some people have like multiple. Some people think that your patrons can change depending on what you need at the time. And that's all of those definitions are completely valid. To brush upon like the idea of having one patron, I'm a traditional demonolater, and in traditional demonolatry we only are allowed to have one patron or one patroness. We don't really use the word matron because that's not really a correct definition, so we prefer the word patroness. But in traditional demonolatry you only get one patron slash patroness, and you're expected to have worked with like 30 to 50 demons before like thoroughly dedicating yourself to your patron of your choice, the one that you have the biggest connection with. You can also, like there are multiple ways to try and connect with a patron. And so traditional demonolatry, you really do need to be really clear before you dedicate yourself to an entity or to a demon. And it's never a requirement. People think that patrons are a requirement. They're not at all. You don't have to have one. I guess if it's like your coven guidelines, probably, but if you're a solitary practitioner, you have absolutely zero obligation to have a patron, just like you have zero obligation to have a deity. You can be completely secular, and that's completely fine. And that's just a quick run-through about the differences between Valkyrianized practices, because Valkyrie is not a traditional demon altar, and so our situations with patrons are slightly different, and we're going to go into that by introducing our patrons. We've gotten all the permission to talk about them, we've discussed with them what we're allowed to talk about, what we're not allowed to talk about, and we're not really going to go into, like, big detail on it either. So, my patron is King Bael of the Goetia, of the Ars Goetia. Honestly, I wouldn't really consider him an official patron. I haven't considered dedicating to him yet, not until a couple more years down the line, personally. But he's my patron, and I follow the definition of where it's, like, the extremely close bond, and I'm only allowed to have one, and I don't plan on, like, switching him or quote-unquote replacing, even though that's, like, really mean. That sounds really mean. But I would never think to replace him at all. Like, I've never really doubted my decision to, you know, ask him to be my patron. And like, that's also, like, the matter of asking an entity to be your patron. Patronage is a two-way street, and I think a lot of people forget that. When they expect that when they're offered by an entity that the entity wants to be their patron, that they have to say yes. Not at all. Just like you can deny a deity because you're busy or you just don't feel that connection, you can totally do that with patrons. And I connected to King Bael through Lucifer, and I've been, you know, we've had that connection for almost a year now, and I've never really once doubted him. He's helped me so much. I can't explain it. I have worked with, like, a fair amount of, like, entities. I have never had a single entity come off as paternal for me, or, like, even maternal, except for my patron, except for King Bael. Like, he's the only one that I've ever gotten paternal vibes from. And so he's a lot like my, you know, my spiritual father. Not like actually, not like literally, very, very metaphorically. It's just that I definitely feel like I have a connection with him that I can't really describe with any other entity that I've ever worked with or I've ever met. And he's, like, helped me through so much in my life. And he encourages me to always do better and continue, like, working on myself and take breaks when I need to. And he's just really kind. Like, he's just there for me. I never had to stress or worry about whether or not it was him that was coming through. I mean, yeah, he's thrown, like, challenges at me, but I've always been able to handle them, and he always reminds me that I'm able to handle them. He's absolutely, like, incredible for me. Like, not everyone will have that same experience with him, and I can't really go into, like, that much detail about what exactly we do, but if I were to describe my connection with him, it would definitely be in the form of, like, a patron, because I've generally never felt that connection with anyone else, and that level of, like, understanding. And he's, like, you know, he's everything to me. If he told me to drop someone and wouldn't give me, like, a solid reason, he will always give me a solid reason in cases where that happens, but, I do put a lot of my faith and my trust in him, and I do trust him more than I trust any other entity in my life, you know? He's been there for me, like, for a while, and I really don't think I'd be half the practitioner, like, without him.
Okay, my turn. Sorry. So, as Corellia said earlier, our patron situations are a little bit different. As Corellia is a traditional demonolater, she can only have one patron at a time. Now, I also abided by this rule and believe that you could only have one patron at a time.
It's actually not one patron at a time. It's kind of just like we only get one patron for the rest of our life.
Oh, yeah. And that was with Leviathan, Emperor Leviathan, an emperor of the... an emperor of hell, Elemental, demon of water, lord of the void, king of the abyss, all that really cool stuff. He has, like Corellia and Kinbale, he has been my patron for very close to a year now. I am super close with him. Very, very paternal energy from him as well. And I haven't felt it as intensely from any other entity out there. He's just so amazing. I love him so much. Everything about him is so cool. And my entire life, I've always just been so drawn to like gigantic sea serpents. Just whether it be in art, in movies, in books, I've always thought that they were just the coolest. And I was so mesmerized by them. And I connected with Leviathan. Well, the way that I figured out that he existed was that I got very interested in this fictional character and learned that it was based off of the Hindu snake god, Anantashesha. And then when I was researching Anantashesha, I came across Leviathan, and I had already gotten an interest in demonology at that point. And then I learned that Leviathan was a very, very prominent demon within the practice of demonology. And just as soon as I read up on him, as soon as I heard of his existence, his name would not stop repeating in the back of my mind. And it would just be on a reel, just 24/7 playing in the back of my mind, before I finally realized that that meant that he was reaching out to me. And I was obsessed with him. I was just so interested in him, and I thought he was so cool. And I was just like, oh, I hope one day he'll work with me. Well, I was saying that while he was actively reaching out, and I just didn't notice. And I just love him. Oh, we're so close. He's done so much for me. He's helped me become so much of a better practitioner and overall person. He's helped me so much with shadow work, so much with understanding myself and others. And he's just amazing, and I love him so much, and I love everything about him. I just think he's the absolute coolest, and he's a really awesome demon. But as I said before, my patron situation is a little bit different. So I have two patrons, and personally, I do think that two is really the max because of the gravity of that relationship, because of how extremely close you are and how important that kind of a relationship is. I just think that really two is the max, and I could not see anyone going above two with the amount of dedication and devotion and energy that goes into that relationship. I just couldn't see how anybody could survive past having two. So my second patron, she is a newer addition to my practice. Leviathan has been around for longer, and I am in the process of training to become his priestess. So I have known him for longer. But my patroness is Sekhmet, and oh, I love her so much. Very sharp contrast to Leviathan. Oh, she's a Kemetic or Egyptian deity. Quite the contrast with Leviathan. Leviathan is all about the abyss, the Ouroboros, the eternal cycle of rebirth, the above and below, a lot of darkness, you know, the deep sea, the abyss. And Sekhmet is very, very fiery. She is a lion-headed goddess. She's known as the Lady of the Bloodbath, Queen of Blades, the Devourer. She's a very, very fiery entity, and her energy is so different from Leviathan. And I think that they just balance each other out very, very well because they're such opposites. They just like really like bring things into a perfect balance for me. And I love them both so much. Sekhmet is amazing. Leviathan is awesome. And they both just bring an amazing balance and stability and calmness to my path.
Yeah, that's really cool. One thing that I was thinking about was I realized that I never really, like, when it came to King Bale, there was never a point where I was, like, looking for a patron. I actually remember pretty clearly I was telling my friend that I didn't feel like I needed to search for a patron, and that's kind of when that connection just showed up, which is really strange, which kind of reminds me that, like, you shouldn't really search for patrons. You should definitely let them come to you, to let it be a gradual process. But one thing that I wanted to bring up that I thought was really fascinating is the elemental difference with your patrons and the elemental comparisons. Because I know Connelly, in one of the exercises with connecting with daemons, one of them is like connecting to your elemental counterpart, so to speak. And it's really funny because like Valkyrie and I are both like pretty water enthused, water filled. But there's a really big dynamic between Leviathan and Bale. Like elementally, Bale is fire and Leviathan is water. And I think when it comes to discussing patron compatibility, talking about the elemental differences is a pretty interesting subject, because you would think that with water and fire it wouldn't work out, but then you'd have to look into more of my chart and like I'm not gonna like currently share everything, but with the amount of like through understanding the placements in my chart, I actually realized that I do need a lot of balance. I'm a person who needs that duality in like every part of my practice. I thrive off of duality, and I didn't realize it for the longest time because I used to like get kind of insecure because I'd be like, oh, my patron and I aren't like elementally compatible, but then everyone else is like so elementally compatible, what's wrong with my relationship, you know? And then I realized that I really do need a lot of duality in my practice, and it's different for everyone. Some people need a counterpart that's really similar to them, the way that they think. But when I have, like, King Bale, he is my opposite. Because I'm just a bundle of emotions and so much water that I don't know how to control it sometimes. And probably having a water entity as my patron would have made that process of trying to understand and work through my emotions so much more difficult. Because maybe I didn't need someone who, like, had a similar way of dealing with my emotions, but I needed someone to give me a completely different outlook on it. And I realized that his outlook on like everything is kind of different from mine, but it's so useful. Like I've been able to expand my emotional horizons, if that makes any sense, because of how opposite we are. And that's definitely a situation where you don't really have to consider that much elemental incompatibility, because you know, opposites attract, so you can go by that. But yeah, Valkyrie, do you have anything to say about you and Leviathan being, like, the same element?
Yeah, me and Leviathan, both being very, very watery, did help us connect a lot in the beginning. I was just, you know, again, I was borderline obsessed with him. I thought he was so cool. I was just, like, so, so interested in him and so drawn to him. And when he came into my life, when I finally realized that he was reaching out to me, I lost it. I was basically fangirling over it. I was so happy. And like when we started interacting, it felt like I always knew him because we were so similar. And it felt like I just knew him so well and he knew me so well. So that elemental compatibility really just helped us connect, and as someone who can be a very stubborn person, it helped to have a patron who does think a lot like me and who makes a lot of sense to me, whose thought process just aligns with mine so well. That helped me a lot in the beginning of my practice. But then again, you really do need to like think about the elements, not really compatibility, but just the elements that you're interacting with as a whole. You really need to consider them, because at one point I kind of did get drowned out in all that water, not just Leviathan, but also I also worked with Empress Unseer, Leviathan's wife, who is like earth and water, but mostly water, and then also Princess Alelogap, who according to my gnosis is Leviathan's daughter, also a very, very heavily, a demon who's very, very heavily associated with the element of water. So I was really, really drowning myself out there and just energetically tiring myself out and making the energy very stagnant. So that's when everyone, like Alelogap and Seer, and especially Leviathan, took a step back, and Sekhmet entered my life. My patroness, who is very, very fiery, is a solar warrior goddess, very fierce, and just having that really intense contrast to what I was used to with just like all the water and all the abyss surrounding me, having Sekhmet come in really did bring me alive again. It really picked up the flow of energy. It wasn't stagnant anymore. And just having that fire brought me alive, and having that different way of thinking, like you said, with King Bale, he thinks much differently than you. And having Sekhmet, who is also very different from me, helped pick things up and helps just pick my practice up again. And having her there just absolutely does help balance everything out. And it's really amazing. And like I said before, Leviathan took a step back. So he has temporarily, I know it's temporarily because I would be so sad if it wasn't. He has taken a step back, and I am not going to be working with him for the next few months. And that brings us into the topic of patrons leaving sometimes.
They do,
And
yeah.
I'll let Corellia talk about this because
Yeah.
she has also experienced this.
Patrons, like, some of them might be lifelong. They're not always going to stay 24/7 because they're, well, it's not necessarily leaving, or sometimes it might come through in taking a step back. But there are some moments where they will think that you might be better off learning from another entity, or your focus needs to be elsewhere and not, directly on them. With my patron leaving, I think it was because I was so attached to him that I wouldn't let myself get close to anyone else, which is like my problem. I had to work on that, and because he left, I was able to learn what it meant to forge really meaningful relationships with everyone else that I was working with. And I'm really thankful for him leaving in order to teach me that. And also, like, at that time, there wasn't really much he could help me with either, considering where my path was going. But I knew he was coming back, and when he did, things were good. Like, I learned what it meant to not be so attached and to kind of like focus elsewhere. And yeah, probably like some elemental balancing helped out with that too, because I didn't really have any fire entities in my life when he departed temporarily. But there's a lot of use in patrons taking a step back. And most, if not everyone, that has a patron will experience their patron stepping back every now and then. You just have to realize that it can be so useful for you. And there's
Well, yeah,
usually like a reason
definitely.
for it.
So I was going to say that demons do absolutely do value independence and being able to take care of yourself on your own a lot. So I do think that they absolutely do take steps back, especially when you're starting to rely on them too much, when it's like you're starting to get a little bit too close with them, that if they like you wouldn't be able to, well, not literally, but more metaphorically, wouldn't be able to survive without them. That's not what the Left Hand Path and the demonic are about. They're not about you like relying an extreme amount on another divinity. Because on the Left Hand Path, you're supposed to be your own divinity. You are supposed to come before anything else, and you're supposed to be able to rely on yourself. So I think patrons take steps back so that you can relearn that and just get that independence and that power back. And again, take the time to be able to experience other practices that perhaps your patron isn't associated with. Just become closer with other entities who are extremely beneficial to your path. So they do take steps back for many reasons and often, and it's honestly to be expected within patron relationships. They will take steps back because you do need breaks at times, and you do need to focus on other things in your life.
Definitely. Okay, our next subject that we're going to talk about is this isn't our experience, but our experience talking to others about their patrons. I think that's also kind of interesting. Not all of our friends have patrons, and that's completely fine. Some of them have experiences where when we first met them, they had like multiple patrons, and then them now it's a lot more different. They usually only have like one, or they have two, or they'll face like times where they kind of doubt their choices. But it's really interesting. It's because when they doubt, they always stick back to their original one at the end. The first entity they like connected with as a patron, which I thought was really fascinating. That which shows that it's completely normal to occasionally feel that lack of a pull, because you know humans thrive off connections. So there are gonna be some moments where we miss that connection, and then there's like a hole where we're like, I wonder if there's a possible chance that, you know, that entity isn't my patron. But at the end of the day, you seem to, like, they all seem to be able to go back.
That doubt is very, very natural and absolutely to be expected, and it's nothing wrong at all if you go through that. You know, humans are not without fault, and you are going to have anxieties, and you are going to have doubts because, you know, you're always scared that you're doing something wrong, or that you're making a mistake on your path or in your practice. But yeah, it is really interesting how we've seen some friends go through a good amount of patrons, but then always stick with the first one. It just shows you how special and how strong and deep-rooted those relationships and those connections are. Like, it's really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Another, I think the issue with patrons is when, we also experience, we've seen this, we haven't experienced it, when you have like 10 plus patrons.
Oh,
and then you like make it really known and really public, because like I said, patrons are like, it gives you like a step up in authority. People will go to you regardless of your experience if they say that, if you tell them, oh, Lucifer is my patron, then they're gonna go, oh my gosh, you have to naturally know more about Lucifer. It's not it. Like, someone can definitely not be a patron of Lucifer, can definitely not have Lucifer as a patron, and know more than someone that has Lucifer as a patron. You know?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that just shows how much effect these labels have on beginners, and how careful you need to be with just what you share and how you talk about your practice and your connections and how you share it. And again, you said that there are people who have 10 patrons. Whenever I see someone with such a large amount of patrons, they're always extremely open about it. Like on online communities, within their biographies, they have lists of like extremely extensive lists of entities and their very detailed relationships with them. They have like 5, 8, 10, 15 patrons, and it's always like they're displaying them in a trophy case, because like they're collectibles. Because again, the term patron, it's kind of like a buzzword. Like, it's very like, oh, patron, like you have this very, very strong connection with an entity, and you're most likely important to this entity. This entity, like, really does love you enough to be your patron, to take on such an important guiding role. And people really like to use this as a way to show off their status, because it's like, oh, look at this. Look at how many entities are drawn to me. Look at how cool I am for having so many patrons. And usually, in reality, they either don't at all or barely ever interact with these entities that they claim to have such a strong relationship with, such as a patron. And it really shows how they're not doing it for themselves. They're doing it for validation from others. They're doing it not for the development of themselves as people, not for the improvement of their craft, but to be seen by others, and to be seen as someone interesting and cool and experienced. when really this comes from a place of lack of pride, of personal insecurity.
Yeah. I think it's like you said, you talked about it pretty well. Which leads us into talking about deity collectors on top of patron collectors, because most people who are patron collectors are naturally deity collectors. So what are deity collectors, or deity collectors? They are people who kind of treat deities like Pokemon cards. And sometimes it's really, like, they'll usually say, oh, I'm not a deity collector. And then they'll have, like, 14 entities in their bio that they're somehow all working with and have all reached out to them. And even if they don't, like, very consciously, like, think that they're, like, they might not see them. They might not see the deities as, like, Pokemon cards. But they still, they act it. They act the part, even if they don't think it. Because part of them usually, like, desires, finds pride through numbers, through quantity over quality relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had our fair share of, like, meeting, like, deity collectors. Usually we just let them be.
So that brings us, am I allowed to segue into the next experience of deity collecting?
Definitely.
So this brings us into our personal experiences with deity collecting, and I can speak on this because in the very beginning of my craft, when I was a very impressionable young practitioner, someone who I looked up to and considered to be very smart and very close to me was actually a deity collector, and they turned me into a deity collector. Thank the gods that did not last very long, and I was someone who did, like, really try to have a relationship with all these entities. At the most it was 13, which is, oh my god, I could never dream of doing that now. At the most it was 13, and I thought that that like it meant that I was so interesting because I thought that all these deities were reaching out to me. And I was at a place in my life where I was very insecure in my practice because I was just starting out, and I saw so many people around me who knew so much more than me. And I just, even though I did know that I was a beginner and naturally I wouldn't be as experienced or as knowledgeable, it still made me feel lesser than. So, like, being recognized by all these deities just made me feel something. But thankfully, not very far into that, after I was already burned out, Queen Rashoon, an amazing demoness, came into my life, and I can't share how, but she really knocked sense into me as to how silly I was for being a deity collector, and she helped me just learn to say no to those who are reaching out, learn to cut off connections that weren't serving me. And thanks to her and Leviathan, I was able to pull myself out of that and become, at least I hope to have become, a respectable practitioner. And in my experience with that, I can say that it always, always comes from a place of insecurity, from a place of feeling lesser than other people and wanting to feel recognized by others and wanting to feel recognized by these deities, and really just collecting them and burning yourself out, all just so that you can look like someone to other people.
Yeah, what's funny is that it's usually a beginner thing. You don't really see people who have been in this for years fall under, like, the scheme of deity. Of course, it's not impossible, but it's just a more rare circumstance to see a seasoned witch, you know, end up a deity collector.
Yeah, and I'd absolutely say this is because deity collectors, again, you get burned out so quickly doing that for a long time. I couldn't even, like, survive, what was it, like a month and a half? 2 months, maybe? Something like that. I barely got out of that. I was so exhausted. So when you're a deity collector for a while, I've seen some people go at it for, like, months and months at a time. like nearly a year, like you just get so burned out that a lot of the time, in the end, you just end up leaving the practice of magic as a whole, and also deity collectors, again, because it's like about that lack of pride, about wanting to show off to other people. It's never about commitment and wanting a true relationship with magic and witchcraft and really having that dedication to the practice. It's never about that. So that dedication and that want to stay in the craft is never really there. So that's why you don't ever see anyone who's been within the practice for years be a deity collector, because it's never about becoming a respectable long-term practitioner to work on yourself and to work on your abilities. It's just always about a temporary high that you get from others seeing you as some interesting and cool individual.
Yeah. And so that kind of just like leads me into like thinking, you know, what is it that makes people like want to put their craft public, especially like that? I don't know, like what you gain. Cause like for me at least, it's kind of embarrassing when I see someone with their like bio and they're like, I work with like 50 deities. I don't think it's a, personally, I don't think it's anything to be proud of. Cause then my question would be like, how are you maintaining that? You know, how are you maintaining that devotion? Are you sure you have like a solidly intimate relationship with, you know, everyone that you're working with? And moving on from talking about deity collectors, we're going to move on to priesthood, which Valkyrie definitely knows a ton about.
So again, so I will be going into what priesthood is exactly, but since we're also still on the topic of deity collectors, I will say that since, like Curlia said, they treat deities like Pokemon cards so that they can show them off to other people and show how cool and interesting they are. This also pertains to very flashy titles like priesthood and like other big things like oracle, seer, all that. They really, really like to grab at those very high status titles and be like, oh, I'm a priest for this deity, I'm a priest for this deity, even though they've only been in the practice for a very, very short amount of time and don't actually like have that amount of dedication that it takes for that, that it takes for something like priesthood. And that's also extremely dangerous, because if you're going to flash the title of priest, people are immediately, especially, like absolutely, especially always beginners, are going to take everything that you say as fact and just believe everything that you have to say and think that you are the perfect role model for them. But obviously, since people who do this are deity collectors and who aren't actually dedicated to their practice, they don't really do research and they don't really know the specifics of what they're talking about. So a lot of the time they spread either very, very shallow views into the practices that they are involved in, or just straight up misinformation. And this takes us into what priesthood is. So very, very generally, priesthood involves dedication to one entity or a group of entities or a category of entities, like dedication to one demon, a group of demons, or just the demonic as a whole. That can also be a part of it. Well, first things first, the absolute first thing that comes with being a priest, which is why I always get pissed off whenever I hear people say that, like, oh, I'm a solitary priest. No. Priests are for the people. A priest has, throughout the entirety of history, throughout every single definition in the book, a priest has never existed without their clergy. They have never existed without serving a community. Being a solitary priest is extremely, extremely hypocritical. A priest, yes, is very, very devoted and very, very dedicated to the divine in their life, but they're also extremely devoted and extremely dedicated to other people within their circles and within their communities. They're there to be a mature and guiding presence, someone who knows what they're talking about, someone who can provide sources, someone who can be a fountain of information, someone who can be calm, who can be a wonderful presence to go to, so that everybody can feel open to go to them with their questions, with their concerns, with everything that they want. Also be a very reliable diviner, and you're supposed to be a welcoming presence, open to helping others and open to all beliefs. And you really cannot be solitary, because you're always there for a community. You're usually also like very much into ritual construction, gaining gnosis or like spiritual knowledge on entities or practices, and like either publishing that work or sharing it with the community around you, because again, you are there for the community. You are there to help a community thrive, and you are there to spread the teachings and morals and values of the divine in your life. And this brings us into demonolatry priesthood. So I will very briefly touch on the two types of priesthoods, like the kinds of priesthood. So we do have, like, of course, everybody knows the priests who work in churches, you know, or temples. Everybody knows those kinds. You know, they usually stand at the front and they preach and they lead ceremonies. And then we have priests for individual entities versus priests for covens or orders. I'll let Corellia talk about covens and orders, but when it comes to individual entities, they reach out to you. The entity reaches out to you. They've usually been your patron for a while, because if you're a priest or a particular entity or entities, then they're the entity you have the strongest connection with, because your goal is to share their morals, their values, their teachings, and help in their communities. So they reach out to you, they give you the offer, and you go under a period of training. In my experience, that can be anywhere from 4 to 15 years. Personally, with me, for Leviathan, I'm allowed to share this, we're looking at 4 to 5 years of training. So you train under an individual entity. They definitely do put a lot of obstacles in your life. You spend a lot of time with them, learning about them. You go through challenges, and you just like it always is very, very personalized when it comes to training under the individual entity itself. So it's always very different, but it's under them. They usually affect your life very greatly to prepare you for priesthood. They lead you in so many different directions. They bring so many people in and out of your life during priesthood. And it is difficult. It is not easy, and sometimes it's not very fun. But it is very difficult, and it's very wonderful in the end to be able to have that title and help people in a community. And that brings us to coven priesthood.
Yeah, so with coven priesthood, I can only really talk about traditional demonology, but the basics is most covens usually have like a residing priestess or a high priestess. There is a difference between a high priestess and a priestess. It's just ranking. High priestess is obviously at like a little bit of a higher ranking than a normal priestess, but they basically kind of like they're part of the clergy of that coven, sect, or order. They might go by different names, but they lead the rituals, they organize the events, they help out with planning, and they're kind of like in a general like teaching position. Like priests technically are teachers in a way. They're basically teachers, but there's I know within traditional demonology there's a couple like classifications of priesthood, but I'm not entirely sure. Like, I can't really talk about that because I don't really know it that well. But there's like funerary priests, seminary priests, and like just general priests and high priestesses. And in like traditional demonology, we have priests that are clergy approved to perform rites like for marriages and funerals. But in general, high priestesses and priestesses are, you know, they organize and they're in a teaching position. They can help out with those who are initiating and help out with that process. And also just like a lot of groups will have like the group itself is dedicated to like a specific demon or a specific entity, a specific divine entity. And so I think priesthood might be one of the only situations, coven priesthood might be one of the only situations where in traditional demonology a person could have two patrons, because they would have their patron and then the coven patron. But essentially, I have never really understood priesthood unless there was a community to be serving, like Valkyrie was mentioning. And that's a really quick rundown on like coven priesthood. They're clergy approved too, so you can't actually choose to be a priest, and it isn't appointed to you by a demon. You have to be recommended by the clergy, by the members of the coven, in order for you to be considered for the training for priesthood. And it usually takes like a couple years, and there has to be like, they go through these things called seminaries, which is like a seminar or a class, but I assume at the end of it, something has to be produced to show that you have a really thorough understanding of who you're priesting for. And priesthood isn't for everyone. Priests have to be sociable, like somewhat sociable, and able to talk and communicate and take on mentees when it comes to it. Not everyone is meant to be a priest. And I think people rush into it a lot. Because, you know, again, with the data collecting, you see people doing it, and you want to follow suit. Because you want to, like, not only conform, but also be approved and heightened in status because of your practice. But not everyone acknowledges the amount of dedication the practice genuinely requires.
Absolutely. And as we said, like, before we started this podcast, it's become a trend. It's become trendy. It's become cool to be a priest, because people, again, don't understand how hard it is, how much work you actually have to put into it, and how many responsibilities you have, and the gravity of such a title. And that brings us into something else that has very recently become a trend and is also very concerning, which is God spousing. So, what is God spousing? God spousing is, there are multiple definitions. Sometimes God spousing is seen as just the highest form of dedication one can give to an entity. So God spousing does connotate marriage, God spouse. So for example, nuns, Christian nuns, they are God spouses. Many denominations wear a wedding ring to symbolize their connection with Jesus and the church. Their entire life is devoted to the Holy Trinity. And this is very similar to lots of types of God spousing, just extremely high amounts of devotion. It's very, very respectable, and it's very, very beautiful. Traditionally, historically, God spousing has just been a very high form of dedication and devotion that usually involves almost like dedication of your entire life to this entity. And then we get into the very, very controversial side of God spousing, where people treat God spousing as an actual committed romantic relationship with this divine entity.
Yeah. I think the issues with there, I mean, there's definitely a lot of issues with God spousing, and like within our community, we've noticed like lately there's been like this rise in like God spouses, which I'm not entirely sure is highly appropriate for a community that's, you know, chock filled with minors. I think Valkyrie and I've talked about, yeah, there's an issue with underaged God spouses.
Absolutely. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I would say that 18 is like a good age to consider it if you've dedicated like years to like working with that entity. But we've definitely met God spouses, quote, God spouses who are like 15, 16, which I think is highly inappropriate personally. But
absolutely.
Valkyrie, I'd like to know your take on that.
Again, even with like that 18 and above take, even 18 is a little bit young. In my opinion, you're still very, very young at 18. And you don't realize how young you are. At any age, you don't realize how young you are, and you think you're so extremely mature, which is where people find it okay to be so young and be God spouses. But in my previous research into God spousing communities, the majority of which are on Tumblr, which should give you a very, very good look into the kinds of people who consider themselves God spouses of the romantic kind. Even in places that are as crazy as Tumblr, I always, always see people say, you have to be 18 and above. You have to be a legal adult. That is because these divinities, these entities, I mean, they're more than adults. They're older than time itself. They're ancient entities. And you cannot be, I'm sorry, in my opinion, I'm very highly opinionated. No entity that is older than time itself will want to be with a child, a 15, 14, 16-year-old who doesn't even know how to drive or take care of themselves, who doesn't even have their view of the world established, who doesn't understand very many basic things. No entity whose inner machinations are so complex, so ancient beyond what anything that we could ever understand, would want to be with a literal child, someone compared to their age, would be a fetus.
Mm-hmm.
A relationship, a romantic relationship, is something that requires endless maturity and dedication on each person's end. And a child, a literal child, is not ready for that. And I get freaked out. I have quite literally seen someone, a 16-year-old, say that they proposed to a certain demon and the demon accepted. Oh.
And I don't want to hear the thing about, oh my gosh, but my soul could be a million years old. Or it could not. Or it could not. But like, you're human now. It's not like you kept the knowledge of like a million years. Like maybe in your soul you feel it, but like, not one, not everyone believes in past lives. And two, like, you are 16 in this life. You have the maturity of a 16-year-old. Like, suck it up.
Absolutely.
Sorry. To excuse that sort of behavior by bringing up like past life stuff is absolutely inappropriate for the situation at hand. Not only that, but like it entirely just like ruins your relationship with love. I feel like it like if you're doing it again, people who are in committed relationships and are also God spouses but have been in this for like decades, yeah, it's totally fine. Like if you can figure out how to balance it, sure. But for underaged God spouses, it can ruin your perception of love. Especially because you're so young, you're still like, there's a lot of hormonal things that are going on in your age.
Yeah, you don't even understand what love is. And for many people, I have seen, like in many communities where this has become a trend, like again with deity collectors wanting to pick up every big title, people wanting to pick up the title of God spouse, for many very young people, this is their first experience with love. And no matter what you say, from a psychological standpoint, that is forever going to taint their experience and their views of love.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about when they have more than one god spouse.
No, with if you look into historical research or even actual committed of age god spouses, they put so much dedication and love and energy into these relationships that it is quite literally impossible to have that kind of a relationship with more than one entity. You could not have a relationship with two entities, such as god spousing. You could not be able to call it god spousing if you have that relationship with more than one entity, because of how extremely dedicated you have to be to that deity.
I mean, I completely agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are so many issues with it, as you can see.
The last thing we really want to talk about is when it gets... Okay, I'm not entirely sure if we're allowed to, talk about this, but I think we are. Mm-hmm. We'll just tap on it really lightly. When it gets sexual.
Oh, absolutely. Again...
If it's a minor, I think that's where it definitely crosses my line.
No, absolutely not. I don't know if we're gonna, if we should be talking about this, but someone published an entire Wattpad story that included a real 16-year-old, and it was a story about this 16-year-old and a very, very romantically intimate experience with a divine being, and just publishing a story that showed so much detail as it did on a public platform that anybody could access just shows that you're not treating this relationship as holy, as divine, as personal. It's an act you're putting up for other people. But yeah, back to the topic, when it gets sexual, there's a difference. There's a very big difference between having intercourse with a divinity and sex magic, which is just the exchanging of energies that happen to be sexual. There is a difference. But either way, if you are a minor, if it's sex magic or if it's literal intercourse, I don't know how literal that can get, you are still having a sexual experience with an entity that is more than an adult. Comparing a divine being with an adult would be a severe understatement. So again, when it gets sexual, that is absolutely not okay. If any 16-year-old told you that they were having sexually and even just romantically intimate experiences with someone who was 40, you would freak out. Anybody would freak out. And 40 is not even close to how old divine beings are. Age doesn't even apply to divine beings because of how ancient and primordial they are.
Exactly. And that's kind of like our takes on these kind of controversial topics. But again, everything is controversial. And you don't have to agree with these opinions. Like, these are just, these are our kind of thoughts and our moral obligations as to why we kind of like think these. But other than that, I think that's basically it for this podcast episode. I'm your host, Karelia.
And I'm your host, Valkyrie.
And thank you for listening to the second episode of Oracles of the Occult.